Hi, this is Jeb Kennison, broadcasting from Palm Springs, California, here today to discuss my book, Death by HR, How Affirmative Action Cripples Organizations, recently published on Amazon and other publishing platforms near you. So I'm Jeb Kennison, and my background is I grew up near Kansas City. I went to MIT and studied engineering and computer programming. I worked on early internet and AI supercomputers down the hall from the guy who picked the at sign for email addresses. I had a varied career doing systems programming, and then I ended up managing other people's money in Silicon Valley during the dot-com era. I've retired to Palm Springs to write about how things work. And with my engineering and economics background, I try to explain it all to you. My books so far are two books on applying attachment theory, psychological theory, to relationship problems. The first one was Bad Boyfriends, using attachment theory to avoid Mr. or Ms. Wrong and make you a better partner. The second book on the subject of a specific attachment type was Avoidant, How to Love or Leave a Dismissive Partner, which has been helpful to apparently many thousands of people who've purchased it and said kind things about me. I've written three science fiction thrillers in a series called The Substrate Wars, which are fairly light entertainment, but also expressing a lot of my views on how things work. And finally, I've come up with Death by HR, How Affirmative Action Cripples Organizations, which is a subpart of a larger problem that I'll get to later on in this broadcast. So if you ask me what qualifies me to do this, I have to say that my varied career in business, from land development to money management and various points in between, gives me a better perspective on the systemic problems of the administrative state and than most people have. I've worked in tech companies and seen how HR is implemented and resisted there, and I've been writing on current affairs of politics and business for many years. My essays at jebkennison.com are often featured on Instapundit. If you ask me, do I have any plans for follow-up books, I'd say I've gathered a lot of material on the government side of these issues enough for at least one more book, which will focus more on dysfunctional government, with civil service and public employee unions as growing menaces to accountability and performance of the administrative state. But if corruption is defined as selling out the interests of those who are supposedly employing you and using campaign contributions to funnel tax dollars back to your pockets, the public employee unions and state agencies, which are dominated by progressive partisans, are corrupt influences that have been putting us on the road to bankruptcy and decay. The public money that they spend to generate propaganda supporting further increases in their power spending is a corrupt feedback loop that has almost destroyed our fiscal order. With public spending on education gradually turning our schools into indoctrination centers that promote bigger government as the solution to every problem, and in fact the background has become so drenched in this kind of attitude that it's very difficult to get anyone who's been through the educational system to recognize that there are either some problems which cannot be solved by anyone, that they're going to be ever present in our lives, like poverty, or they cannot be addressed or solved by a government program. And they simply have to be worked at by individuals acting locally. So basically, I took all the material I had and worked on the part that was related to private business and HR's application of government rules inside businesses to promote a certain kind of attitude toward productivity. And in the book, I trace the history of the HR department from its earliest days as the personnel department, which was in charge of payroll and records, to today's Human Resources Department, which claims to view employees as assets to be discovered, recruited, and nurtured as a key part of company's management. Now, there was a time when basically the manager of a small group was completely in charge of the employees that he had under him, and would hire and fire based on his own personal prejudices and reward people because he liked them as much as anything else. This, of course, would be bad management, and companies recognizing this tried to apply some sort of uniform standards so that employees would be reasonably well-treated and not disgruntled. And that way they could discover what managers were doing a bad job and which ones were being employing favoritism more than productivity as their measure. HR attempted to do that, but it also became wrapped up in the government relations issue. In other words, how to protect the enterprise from being punished by government or falling into the trap of violating a labor law and getting punished, which would be very bad for the enterprise as a whole. So the reality of HR has been different than the story used to promote it. HR is designed primarily to protect the company from lawsuits and government punishments. Since it's a department that's separated from the company's productive work and has a different culture and focus, HR tends to act to enforce government labor laws and equal opportunity dictates, and its staffers tend to be ignorant of how product design, engineering, and marketing work to create profitable products, enabling revenues and growth. While HR pretends to serve managers, most managers find them more of a hindrance than a help, and managers work around them to find the best employees when they're hiring. The phenomenon of regulatory capture occurs when a government regulator evolves to favor the businesses it is supposedly regulating, with a revolving door that pays off industry-friendly regulators with lucrative new careers as lobbyists using their influence to convince their old co-workers to protect the interests of the biggest companies. A prime recent example was Marilyn Tavenner, the official in charge of the rollout of Obama's healthcare.gov, moving directly into a high-paid position as a top lobbyist for the nation's health insurance industry. The fact that no one in the mainstream media thinks that that's a significant development is interesting. HR would be a good example of reverse regulatory capture, where the department's designed to keep businesses out of trouble with labor and equal opportunity regulators came to view the regulator's agenda as more important than the future of the business that's paying their salaries. Of course, there are many people in HR who are working hard to try to promote their organization and keep them out of trouble while getting to the goal of higher productivity. But the overall view of HR in its public relations and in its what it actually acts to do is to be conservative and to avoid trouble wherever possible, being unwilling to take even the slightest risk for a future more productive work team. And so they will go ahead and use affirmative action goals to diminish the ability of teams to accomplish their goals. You can look at HR as the administrative state's parallel enforcement arm within private organizations, much as the old Soviet Union had commissars, which were political officers shadowing all military units. Instead of ensuring party control of the military, HR acts to enforce political control of businesses. And because they don't understand how products are actually produced and what a productive employee looks like, HR tends to recruit those who have paper credentials and favored diversity profiles over those who are most likely to be productive in the job. A good example of this is the male engineer who is clumsy at communicating with women he's attracted to and may lack in hygiene and fashion sense, and is typically screened out by female HR recruiters as not desirable, even when that type could be the most productive programmer or engineer in the applicant pool. Though newly sensitive to racial and sexual stereotypes then, many HR employees are entrusted to screen applicants but are blind to their own prejudices. One of the reasons Silicon Valley engineering companies can still function is that managers ignore candidates HR brings to them in favor of candidates they found through industry contacts and networking. bowing to continuing political pressure to force more hiring of less productive diversity candidates will damage growing high-tech companies. The tendency to use good enough as a mask for discrimination. Labor laws dating back to the 1930s and before, when industrial unions gained political power, tended to treat employees as more or less interchangeable cogs, expected to work on the clock and produce no more than the other employees because their process of production was assembly line and there was really no opportunity to shine and be more productive. The advent of affirmative action forced government and private employers to start hiring minorities and women who would not have qualified as the best candidates had objective tests and qualifications been used. The good enough test of the labor union was disguised by language like equally qualified to mean passed a very low bar, with tests weakened and qualifications relaxed to allow more minorities to be hired before much more promising applicants. And the adverse impact test, meaning any test or requirement which tended to screen out more minority candidates, was deemed discriminatory at law, which is why most tests of competence and specialized job knowledge disappeared from civil service and private company screenings for employment. Since then, there's been a quiet war between external political authorities, aided by their enforcers in HR, and managers who knew they would be judged by the performance of their teams and wanted the best team members. This war has been going on for two generations now. So how does my book, Death by HR, help? Well, first I outline the problem and how we got here. It could be helpful to understand the history and the justifications for many of these directives, which are forgotten long after they were put into place, and they're no longer actually helping the people they were intended to help. I cover some of the ways managers and employees can fight back by routing around their HR departments and passively resisting directives from HR. Many of the hoops HR asks employees to jump through are unenforceable bureaucratic busy work. No one can be forced to report their accurate race, sex, or religion, for example. Claiming to be a Native American princess on your application to teach at a law school seems to be a valid exercise of self-identity in the modern era, where what you believe you are has to be accepted by the system. We don't have tests for racial makeup, and we don't, in theory, allow discrimination by sex or race. So be whatever you need to be when the system has decided to discriminate against the race or sex you thought you were. For company executives and management, who should be highly concerned about the effect that bureaucratic HR is having on their productivity, I outline how to find HR heads and staff members who will strive for excellence without getting into legal hot water. One key recommendation is to hire HR staff who have experience in business operations and haven't been programmed to see progressive diversity goals and feel-good PR as the most important part of their job. In particular, avoiding the people who have been through HR programs in academia and selecting people with broader skills is likely to get you a more rounded HR staff. The much larger problem that I'm trying to address here, which is seen in government and HR, is progressivism, which is a philosophy that the government will enforce rules for living that have been dreamed up by highly credentialed elite technocrats to force everyone else to uplift and improve society by doing what their betters think is best. Progressives began and expanded the regulation of employment conditions and wages. Began to infringe on voluntary negotiation of contracts of employment for your own good. The Supreme Court stood in their way until they were persuaded to expand the Commerce Clause during the New Deal years, sort of arm-twisted by FDR and friends. And the result is that the micromanagement of employment and hiring that grew HR into the deadening bureaucracy it is in most companies today got its start then and grew through the 70s and the Civil Rights and EEOC eras. And yet for progressives, it's never enough. No problem that's addressed by progressive regulations is ever resolved by them. And progressive politicians continue to make up issues like the gender pay gap, which they will solve through further regulation if you elect them again. The federal government now has its finger in every pie, interfering with the freedom of small business, community banks, and average citizens to do business and pursue happiness in their own way. Even when a problem is substantially solved, bureaucracies will invent new problems to address with annual rewrites of tightening regulations far beyond what was needed to address the original issue. For example, the EPA, which has used suspect science to justify ever more stringent air pollution rules, and suspect economics to claim that the new regulations will be cost-effective. As a result of all these regulations, the part-time and low-paid service industry jobs that account for almost all the job growth since 2008 are almost all that's available to younger people entering the job market. We need mind your own business to return as an American motto. Having the government mind everyone's business is leading to stagnation and an end to American growth, with new business formations declining for the last 20 years. Examples of perennial progressive campaigns that can never actually be ended. Homelessness. We hear about homelessness primarily when Republicans are in charge of the national government. But it's been a continuing problem for several generations now. And for example, San Francisco now spends $240 million a year on homeless programs, but doesn't track the results to discover whether they're doing a good job or not. There's no indication that any amount of money spent on social workers and programs would decrease the homeless population. The public might be better served by just handing each homeless person a check for the $40,000 a year being spent supposedly on their behalf. But an ever-increasing number of public employees and private contractors depend on continuing growth in that spending. Another fine problem that isn't really a serious problem is the gender pay gap. Paying women less for equal work has been illegal since the 1960s, and most studies show almost all of the lower average pay to women is the result of their individual choices and preferences for types and conditions of work. Yet progressive politicians pretend there is still rampant pay discrimination, which they can fix with more and more regulations. And then there was the health insurance problem, supposedly solved by Obamacare, or the ACA, which was ran through by a coalition of progressive politicians and rent-seeking insurance and pharma companies. The outright lies about its cost and effectiveness are by now well known. But while doubling the costs for many of the unsubsidized consumers in the private insurance market, it did not result in the promised cost savings and lessened ER visits, which have actually increased, or improving healthcare outcomes. By mandating coverages for routine care to satisfy progressive ideals, the ACA trampled on freedom of choice and religion and demonstrated that even high-profile new programs could not be implemented competently by progressives and their government contractors. And then we have the VA, our foremost example of government-run healthcare, which demonstrated how poorly it serves its clients by denying many veterans timely appointments, and hundreds died waiting while the unionized bureaucrats responsible went unpunished. The VA appears to be operated mostly for the benefit of its unionized civil service employees. The VA, which originally focused on rehabilitation and care for direct service injuries, was expanded to cover all health care for qualifying vets, which it does poorly. Efforts to provide a private care escape valve have been sabotaged, and the faulty incentives of any government bureaucracy ensure that the VA can't reliably deliver low-cost quality and timely care as it is currently structured. People ask me, well, why didn't I support Donald Trump? During the primaries, I favored several candidates over Trump, but his selection of the CEO of a restaurant company, Andrew Puzder, as his labor secretary is a sign that he favors a thorough regulatory overhaul. I'm hopeful his administration and Congress will start dismantling the overbearing administrative state, which has grown into an unaccountable leviathan, stifling the economy and job prospects for everyone outside the coastal elites. You know, so I'm hopeful. Many of his appointments look like they're interested in radical reform. the kind of reform that the establishment in D.C. has been unwilling to do for the last 20 or 30 years when we have recognized that it's becoming a problem. The overburdened regulation of business is stifling economic growth and creating a problem where people are being highly educated at great expense, undergoing significant student loan debt that's crippling their ability to start families and buy houses, but finding jobs that simply don't pay very much because very few people are willing to start new businesses and take risks in an environment where a bureaucrat can step out from nowhere and stop them whenever they want to. So seeing as how the old system was not working well, trying something new seems wise, and I approve of the electorate at least blocking out the conventional wisdom for a while to try something different. That doesn't mean anything will get better, but it's worth a try. Thank you. This has been Jeb Kinnison talking about death by HR, and I appreciate your listening.